Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Need expert advice on your family's health? Speak to us today. Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
So the Rugby World Cup gets underway in France tomorrow. Ireland facing Romania on Saturday afternoon in their opening match. And during the finals, a special exhibition will be held in the Irish Cultural Centre in Paris, celebrating the rugby relationship between France and Ireland. Well, curator of the exhibition and UCD historian Paul Rouse tells a fascinating story of rivalry, friendship and cultural change uniting the two nations for 12 decades. And Paul joins me in studio to tell me more. This is a really fascinating history that I think a lot of people won't be aware of. Where did the idea, first of all, for the exhibition come from, Paul?
The idea came from the Centre Culturel in Paris and from the Irish Embassy in Paris, who thought to use the Rugby World Cup as a way to explore the social, cultural and economic relationship between Ireland and France. And if you look at where it's been held, it's on Rue des Irlandais in beside Pantheon, which is again beside the Sorbonne in the Latin Quarter. So it's in this incredible building in a beautiful area in Paris. And it's to draw people into this Irish college, what was the Irish College, which is one of the Irish colleges that has been in Paris since the 1570s. And it's to open it to beyond the artists and musicians and playwrights who normally would frequent it, to as many Irish people as wish to go and who are in the city and free over the next 6 weeks.
And rugby fans and non-rugby fans will be really interested in this, because if you go back and look at the history, it was Britain that had a huge influence on the development of rugby, both in France and in Ireland.
Well, it's British expats who brought the game to both places, who helped codify it. You look at in Ireland, we know the role that Trinity College had in both the foundation ultimately of the Irish Football Union, which became the Irish Rugby Football Union in the 1870s. And in Paris, it was British expats in Le Havre and then in the Paris Football Club who founded it. And it was about the cultural and economic power of the British Empire and British imperialism in the late 19th century, which spread this game and was then adopted by the elites of different countries. So in Paris, it was people like Pierre de Coubertin, the founder of the Olympics, who actually refereed the first French championship final because he loved all things English. And he tried to take the idea of English muscularity from the English public school and bring it to France and give it to their elite so that the French would join the British in their successful imperial endeavours.
It's hard to introduce a new sport anywhere, isn't it? How quickly did it catch on in both countries?
It caught on. Rugby's really interesting. It did not spread the way soccer spread through the masses. Rugby spread, first of all, through elites. And in Paris, it was taken on by the elites of Parisian society. And it was a while before it got going, and really only after the First World War that it spread to a mass public in France. And it was at that point that France began to be successful and to win matches. But it is really difficult to spread a sport, particularly because it implies you must shift out the sport that's already there.
Yes. And was that the case in Ireland?
In Ireland, rugby was in a contest very early on with both the GAA and with soccer for the broad football-based games and field sports-based games. But it became a little bit later into Paris, it was more of a struggle in France
to grow it. So then the first meeting between Ireland and France, 120 years ago?
Yeah, in 1909, out in Lansdowne Road, now the Aviva, a load of French people came over to the city to this first game. France had played their first ever international in 1906 against the All Blacks. They bring a team over. And the band of the Dublin Metropolitan Police struck up La Marseillaise as the French players came out onto the field, and the crowd went wild for the occasion. Ireland won relatively comfortably, but it was the first step in a relationship between the two countries. We saw the Irish go back there the following year. They took a train. They were cheered off by crowds from the train station in the middle of Dublin, went by boat train through London, across into Paris, and again won relatively comfortably, but 4,000 people came to the game. And by the start of the war, there were 14,000 people at the games.
Right, and then at that we had the Five Nations in 1913 before the start of the war, didn't we?
Yeah, the Five Nations started in 1910 when France joined officially, and it was only in the 90s when Italy joined that it became the Six Nations. But in that competition, it immediately became a thing. for people, supporters, to travel in both directions.
Yeah, and the reason I mentioned 1913 and the Five Nations was, of course, after that then, the people who played in that game, a great many of them perished in the war.
There's an extraordinary series of photographs which survive from a meeting between Ireland and France, which was played in Cork, in the middle of Cork in 1913. And the French players had come over on the ship, and the Irish players had taken trains to Cork, and they played each other because, of course, it was the nearest point for crossing, and
yes,
it made sense. And thousands of people came over from France, and they went to the races in Cork for the weekend. They had a splendid time. But the photos show, they tell a tale of death, if truth be told, because if you look at, just take two players, Albert Eutropius from France, who was born in French Guiana, he died in Africa during the Great War. And Albert Lewis Stewart, the Irish captain from the day, he survived the Battle of the Somme and he died 2 years later in Passchendaele. He was 28 years of age when he died. And they are two of 128 rugby internationals who died during the Great War, and many thousands more of club players from Ireland and from Britain and from France also died during that war.
Yeah, just highlights the waste of life again, you know,
entirely.
These things. So then we have the post-war period, post the First World War. What happens to rugby in France and Ireland in that period?
It exploded in interest in both countries. It's one of the great kind of contradictions of Irish history that a free state was established supposed to promote Gaelic culture, and next thing there's an explosion of rugby and of soccer during those years as well. And in France, it grew from being an elite sport and spread everywhere into the masses. It became the subject of new silent films. It was recorded on records, and Marc Chevalier and all of this stuff helped to spread a culture of rugby and huge crowds going. But there was a problem.
There was a problem. The French got a bit rough, did they?
The French did two things. They understood that they needed to give money for those people who could not afford to play the game. So they began to pay players from the south of France in various shapes and form, in like jobs and money.
Yeah.
And against the strict rules of amateurism in the time, this was a significant problem. And they were spectacularly violent, it would appear. So in 1931, France were thrown out of the Five Nations after being really competitive through the 1920s. They were then thrown out.
Can you imagine that? The scandal of it, getting kicked out of the Five Nations.
And it tells you an awful lot, though, about the nature of rugby at the time and its class basis and the people who controlled the game and what their expectations were for the people who were played. Actually, if you think of the dinner menus from that period, the dinner menus from that period are unbelievable to look at. The French come to Dublin and there's champagne and there's oysters, and the Welsh come and it's beer and burgers.
Yes,
so
OK. So it's not across the board. It depends on who's coming, what they get.
Absolutely.
So when do the French get back in then? When are they allowed back?
Straight after the Second World War, the French came back into what became again the Five Nations, and the competition began to grow and grow through the 40s and the 50s. Crowds grew year after year, and France began to develop the style of rugby which was seen as being free-flowing and full of spirit and hugely attractive, and they began to become really successful. Mm. They became in the 50s the first country ever to go to South Africa and win.
So, and in the modern era, we have seen periods of time when France completely overtake Ireland in terms of rugby, and they dominated in that rivalry between the two countries.
In the three decades between early 1970s and 2000, Ireland could only beat France once in Paris. Just couldn't go there and win. And France just dominated. They dominated the Triple Crowns and they began to win championships. And Ireland were really, really stuck until the dawn of professionalism.
OK, well, I want to move now to what's happening at the tonight in Paris, because we have our football players. You're a football fan as well, aren't you, Paul?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you'll be watching that one. We have another rivalry, Euro 2024 clash between France and Ireland in Paris this evening. And I'm joined by David Snaid, who's soccer correspondent at the 42.ie. David, you're very welcome. Some of the Irish players, I know they probably don't remember the infamous Thierry Henry handball. The 22-year-old defender Nathan Collins, I'm sure people heard this, he had this bizarre story during the week about where he was on that night back in 2009. Will you tell us the story of what Nathan Collins was doing?
In fairness, it was a great one because it was actually at the start of the week, and obviously a few of the different Ireland players were put up for media. And, you know, it's the start of the week, it's such a big game, and everything was all very serious. And then obviously the question naturally towards the end of the chat with Nathan Collins was, oh, well, what are your own memories of the handball and everything that went with it? And you're kind of thinking, oh, he's going to talk about like bawling his eyes out, crying and all the rest. But he was actually at one of those Childline Cheerios concerts in the Old Point Depot. And the thing that stands out from him was getting to go and see JLS. I think everyone was like X Factor or one of those bands. And then he actually does remember people huddled together, at a dart station afterwards, getting the train back and stuff, and people actually being obviously crying and all the rest. So
for him, that probably feels like a very long time ago. For some of us, it doesn't feel like it was too long ago since JLS were playing in a big concert. Will we move, David, to what's happening now? Because, you know, Evan Ferguson, that announcement, it really poured cold water on Ireland's chances both this week and next week against the Dutch. How are they dealing with that blow, and how much of a problem is it for them?
Well, yeah, naturally, it's a massive problem. Like, he's the most exciting young striker now in the Premier League, obviously coming off the back of his hat-trick at the weekend. Like, he'd already now emerged as the number one striker for Ireland over the last 6-7 months. You know, he's kind of, not that he's come from nowhere with Brighton, but he's really taken his chance at like such a young age, and like 10 goals and 12 Premier League starts. Like, it's almost unheard of. You know, he's the first 18-year-old since Michael Owen back in 1999 to actually score a hat-trick. So that just in the Premier League. So that gives you an indication of where he's at and the kind of some of the achievements he's doing. Mm-hmm. Now, with Ireland and where it's at, it's probably even a good thing that it's happened early in the week. It's not something that maybe has flared up again in training yesterday or even on the day of the game. Stephen Kenny's had a chance to digest this now, as it would have been a serious blow, because even just from speaking to people in the camp and all the rest of it, like the game plan that's been in operation really for the last number of weeks has all been centered about, well, how do we get Evan Ferguson to get his chance, have his half chance, because he is now that striker of a caliber where he's only going to need that chance, that half chance to score. And realistically, against the France team that haven't lost a European qualifier at home in 13 years, that's all Ireland are going to get. We talk about how you're going to actually score goals. The best chance against them in the Aviva back in March, when it was a tight game, came from actually a Nathan Collins header from a set piece. In terms of free play, working around opportunities and try to create that space for a player like Evan Ferguson, that's what Stephen Kenny and his staff would have been working towards. That's gone, and now it's obviously up to someone like Adam Eda, another young player, another one of those players who was developed by Stephen Kenny with the 21s and brought into the senior squad, maybe ahead of schedule, who now has the biggest opportunity of his life.
So we'd be very happy coming out of that with a draw.
Oh, come here, listen to Paul there and stuff and talking about films and all the rest of it. There'd be a DVD made of it if Ireland get a draw in France. Like, it's one of them where, even just in the nature of how it would set up the game against the Netherlands on Sunday, France put far past the Dutch in earlier in the campaign. Like, France haven't conceded a goal so far. They just do not lose at home in games. Like, the last defeat, which maybe bodes well for Ireland, the last defeat was against Belarus back in, I think it was 19 years now, or maybe a bit less than that. And the only aspect that, if you're Stephen Kenny and you're drawn back on what happened in March, is, and the way Ireland played, they were able to frustrate France. They were able to
annoy them a bit. But Mbappe is in good form and he's well and everything. There's no chance that he might be unwell for any reason, no?
No, he's coming off the back of scoring. And like, I was writing about this kind of flippantly, saying, well, the only transfer window that's actually still open now is the one in Saudi Arabia, but he's hardly going to be wanting to send out a come-and-get-me plea to the Saudis again with a big performance.
Probably
against
not.
Ireland. You know,
all right, David, we'll have to leave it there. France versus the Republic of Ireland in the Euro 2024 qualifier. You can watch it from 7 o'clock this evening on RTÉ2 and the RTÉ player. There'll be a live blog on RTÉ.ie and the RTÉ News app, of course, or you can listen to the live commentary on 2FM's Game On. Paul, thank you very much for coming in, and thank you to David too for speaking to us. That's it. That's all we have time for today. The programme was produced by the series producer Alistair McConnell, research by Ciarán Donn, our broadcast coordinator Jarlath Holland, and James Feeney on sound. Over to Louise.